My purpose this afternoon is to go into some details about the book of Ecclesiastes to help you to understand it so that as we study through it, as I preach from it, that you will have an opportunity to have this information that will provide some groundwork and help you to understand that. I mentioned this morning that the book of Ecclesiastes does have a certain mystery about it. Mystery might not be the right word for it. It's very interesting that so many different people and so many different types of people come to the book of Ecclesiastes and find something there that's attractive to them, or something that catches their attention. For the older generation, there are some of you that the music of Ecclesiastes shows up in, let's see, who are you saying, Dave? The Birds and Bob Dylan, and there's some songs from the book of Ecclesiastes that come out. There's just something there that captures people's attention. There are a variety of interpretations as well that come to different conclusions. And I'll admit that there are some difficulties that I'm not sure I'm going to be able to solve. There are just some things about it that go beyond even the best attempts at explanation. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't consider it. In fact, it invites us to consider it and to take what God has given for our good, and where there is especially opportunity to for understanding and application, I'll preach and teach with confidence, knowing that God has given this to us for our benefit. So I want to go over a couple of technical things to start off with, and then cover some of the themes of the book. This is the first verse of Ecclesiastes, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. That's going to help us to answer the question, who is the author? From that, you might think that, well, everybody knows who that is. That's Solomon. Well, the funny thing about scholarship is they can take things that seem to be very obvious and make them very confusing. There's actually quite a bit of debate over who the author is, and I want to show you a little bit about that. There are some interesting things here, though. Last night, Dave was saying as we left the play that we get to hear two preachers today. The preacher being me, coming to bring God's word to you, and the preacher that's identified in Ecclesiastes. The word preacher that is given here is, well, this is the Hebrew, that this word right here, very easily demonstrated. You read, Hebrew reads from this way, and this word right here is the Hebrew word that is transliterated Q-O-H-E-L-E-T, or you may see it with a T-H on the end. So Koheleth is the way it's usually pronounced. That word itself comes from the Hebrew root word, three letters, to make it easy, the Q, H, and L that you see in the English. Drop the A's out, you get the root Hebrew word. That word is actually very well known in the Old Testament. It's the word that is used to identify the assembly of the people of God. They are the called out ones, or the ones who are called together. So oftentimes, or if you take a concordance and you look for the word kahal, your Strong's concordance can do that. You can follow the numbers on your Strong's, or you can use a computer program to do that, and you'll find that it refers to all those places of the assembly of God's people, the ones who are called together. So the word koelet is a different form of the word, and it's thought to have the meaning the one who calls out, or the one who calls together, or the one who speaks to the assembly. That's where we get the idea of preacher, the one who speaks to the assembly in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. So you're going to kind of trace through where we get that name. For those of you who love language, the Hebrew is used in the Greek to be ekklesia. You might know that word. It comes right into Latin, and then into English, words we have like ecclesiastical relationships or ecclesiastical history. What are we talking about when we're talking about ecclesiastical history? Anybody? Church history. So it's a translation of the word assembly or church. We've translated it in English as church. Ecclesia refers to that. So koelet is translated Ecclesiastes, and that's the name of the book. That's where the name of this book of the Bible comes from. It's the Latin word for the preacher, Ecclesiastes. Well, so who is Koelet? Who is the author? Who is the preacher is the question. Traditionally, as I said, the church has identified it as Solomon. It's darker here on this screen than it. Kind of a nice picture of Solomon, I thought. You can tell that this man must be very wise by the shape of his beard, I think. Well, back to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. The author says that it's the preacher or Koelet who's speaking, and further identifies himself as the son of David, who is king in Jerusalem. That makes it fairly easy for us to do that, to identify who that is. The Solomon who came after, or the king who came after David, who reigned in Jerusalem, who was the son of David, is Solomon. Later on, in chapter 1, verse 16, you find that the author identifies himself as being full of wisdom, something that we examined this morning from 1 Kings. I think I kept saying 1 Corinthians this morning. 1 Kings identifies Solomon as the one who asked God for wisdom. Chapter 2, verses 4 through 9 say that he had incredible wealth. We see that God also blessed Solomon with the things he didn't ask for. He blessed him with lots of wealth. We also find that often in the book of Ecclesiastes that Solomon speaks of the work of the king, and actually has quite a bit to say about ruling righteously and ruling with discernment. You remember that was Solomon's request. He asked God that he might have wisdom and discernment so that he might rule justly, and he might be able to render good judgment. There are only two people in Scripture that are identified as the son of David. I've identified one of them. Do you know who the other one is?
Jesus.
Yeah, that's right. We have the son of David is Solomon, and the son of David is Jesus. That's going to be significant in my mind as I go on to prepare and to preach on this, as I'm convinced that King Solomon, the son of David, was looking forward to the ultimate son of David. I told you this morning that Solomon, in all his wisdom, could not attain faithfulness. He failed. He failed grandly and famously. But he, I believe, is clinging to the Son of David, Jesus Christ. He's clinging to the covenant promises of God. Just so you know, one other picture here. Again, that's darker here than you. Can you tell what this is about? Okay. What do you see here? What do you see here? What's this here? It's a little hard to see. So, what is King Solomon saying to do? Yeah, cut the baby in two. And what did? I'll ask the back row back there. So, whose baby was this? This one or this one? The one who's pleading for mercy or the one who's saying, yeah, let's cut the baby in two? Yeah, the one who's pleading for mercy. Why is that? Yeah. Yeah. I didn't really preach on that account this morning, but it follows immediately after Solomon's request for wisdom. And he demonstrates a wisdom, giving a judgment between two women. They were arguing, and part of the responsibility of the king was to hear judicial cases and to render judgment. And he was blessed with God's wisdom to render this judgment. So, just so you know, we'll come to that theme in a minute. So just so you know, there are scholars who say that Koheleth, the author that is identified in Ecclesiastes, is not Solomon. In fact, they will prefer to refer to him just as the preacher or as Koheleth to make that distinction. It's true that the name Solomon is not used in the book of Ecclesiastes. That's one reason that they say that it must not be Solomon. They suggest that someone later wrote in the style of the wisdom of Solomon. Much of Proverbs is attributed to Solomon, and without argument is attributed to him. And so they say, well, here's another example of a book kind of like Proverbs. There are places where there are collections of wise sayings that don't have a storyline to it, and that somebody later collected all of these sayings and attributed them to Solomon. Others say that maybe Solomon was the author of some of those sayings, but that there are some other wise men that did that, and someone later who collected them. There are a variety of other things that are argued to say that it wasn't Solomon, but it gets pretty complex. I'll say one other a little bit later, but that's I'm not going to go any deeper to that. As I said this morning, I don't find any reason to go away from the traditional understanding that it is King Solomon. In fact, I think that the questions that are raised can be answered in the context of seeing that traditional framework. So I'm going to be treating it as Solomon. I won't go away from that. Just another quick comment: the date of a book is often instructive or helpful, and in this case, it's not so helpful because it hinges a lot on who you think wrote it. So if you approach the book with the presupposition that Solomon wrote it, then you would date it around the time that Solomon lived, about the 10th century B.C. The scholars who say that it wasn't Solomon claim that there are other influences that may be detected, and they date it in about the 3rd century BC, so approximately 200 to 300 BC, after the exile, after the return of the exiles, after the return of the exiles to Jerusalem. Again, the question about the style of Hebrew there is a little bit beyond me. I know Hebrew, I've studied it, but the nuances that they claim to find there are master's or PhD level discussions that they have about the about it. Again, competing scholars, one says, well, this Hebrew is obviously not 10th century Hebrew. Another one says, you've missed the point that this is Hebrew poetry, and that Hebrew poetry reads differently than other Hebrew. I lean to that side, that this is not narrative Hebrew. This is not something that's telling a story, that this is going to be different because of the different type of literature it is. It is Hebrew poetry or Hebrew wisdom literature. I'm going to go on to theme, but I'll stop and ask if you have any questions or comments about that.
Bruce, is there some question as to whether or not the word preacher is in the feminine form? Is there a string of arguments along those lines that a woman wrote
Yes. The word itself has, it's kind of a weird word. It has the Hebrew stem, that three-letter stem, that in general has a masculine variety to it or a masculine form to it, but the ending of it is a feminine ending. And there are a couple of explanations to it. One is that the author is a female, and leading to wondering what is it that, who is it that's calling? Is it a prophetess, or is it someone like that speaking to the assembly? The explanation on the other side is that there are, if you've studied other languages, you'll know that there are that masculine and feminine don't necessarily refer to the actual gender of the person who's being indicated. So in Latin, if I remember correctly, a poet has a feminine ending. So the poet may be either a man or a woman, but the ending of the word is strictly defined as being feminine. So that's a little etymology, but you're right. The ending is feminine, but you can make of that what you want.
When you talk about the type of Hebrew, how similar or dissimilar is this Hebrew to the Hebrew in Proverbs?
I find it to be similar. I find it to be similar in vocabulary and in patterns and in pacing, but my Hebrew is not accomplished. I'll put it that way. When they start talking about Hebrew, you can find pages and pages of people saying, "Oh, there's influence from Babylonian that can be seen here," and I can read and I can understand and follow the argument, but I don't see it that scholars have suggested that. That's why I say it really gets pretty technical and pretty deep. Any other questions or comments? Were you raising your hand, Logan?
No.
Oh, okay. Okay, that's good. Okay. Theme. There. It is a little difficult to answer this question in any intro to a book. And your, for instance, if you have a New Geneva Study Bible or a Reformation Study Bible or something like that, there will be an introductory page. They'll typically go over the author, the date, the circumstance, the themes, and give you a little bit of an outline of the book. It's good to do that, and that's why I'm going to attempt something of an answer here. But it is a little difficult for a couple of different reasons. I mentioned this morning that because of this difficulty that people have come to approach it in even contradictory ways. Some say it's a scathing irony with a very pessimistic view of life. Others say it's positive, and that that the existence of God that is declared there in the conclusion will help you to understand the rest. You'll find those contradictions, though, throughout the book of Ecclesiastes. It seems to be part of the nature of what Solomon wrote here. So the strength of that contradiction could go even as far as this. He says, everything is meaningless, so get wisdom. But wisdom is meaningless. You can kind of see where they might come to these conclusions. Like, wow, listen to how pessimistic it is. What I've suggested this morning is that Solomon will speak from that worldview without God, and then contrast it. And this is where some of the contradiction comes in. He'll say, "This is meaningless, but still God exists." And I'm not able to explain some of this meaningless, but I can affirm that God exists. And you'll find that tension in the book of Ecclesiastes. The nature of the book also lends towards having some difficulty to determine a theme. So a book like Genesis, or a book like Matthew, or something like that, you can tell that there's a strong purpose that runs throughout the book. Matthew is presenting the birth, life, and death of our Savior Jesus Christ. It just kind of runs through and unifies it. But Ecclesiastes doesn't really have a single storyline, as it were. The nature of the book is sometimes very similar to Proverbs, in that there seem to be a collection of wise sayings. In fact, just as I've done some research on it, a lot of people will approach it that way, just as a kind of a collection of wise sayings. You'll even find those wise sayings lifted out to form very pleasant morals and posters that you can find on the internet. So, this is from Ecclesiastes. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. Ecclesiastes 4:12, though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. Ecclesiastes 10:2, the heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left. Well, we respect and we pray for our leaders, but that one was just too choice. It is tempting to just kind of pick those very memorable sayings out and to develop a sermon series from those individual wise sayings. And I'm going to treat those. I'll get to them. leaning to the right or to the left. I'll come to those things. But I'm going to try to resist the temptation to just kind of cherry pick that one out. And there's a reason for that, is that Solomon wrote an entire book. And there's something about that entirety that comes together. I put this slide in just because it draws together the theme of Ecclesiastes kind of in a visual way. I'd call out some of the things that you see here in this slide. Just go ahead. Yeah, just call it out. Uh-huh. Meaningless? Yeah. Yep. It's clear on the... It's all kind of jumbled together in this slide, isn't it? But certain things pop out at you. Well, there are two reasons that one commentator especially cites for this. The first is that you do need to remember that this is Hebrew wisdom literature. It's, first of all, it is a different language. It's not English. It is Hebrew, and because of that, it has a different vocabulary, a different pace, a different cadence to it. The Hebrew mindset is different than ours. For those of you who have traveled to a different country, do the people in that foreign country think the same way you think? They don't. Any illustrations of that?
Driving on the left side of the road to the right.
Sure, yeah. Very. That's a very practical one, Sam. Yeah. What might you find to eat in China that you wouldn't eat here?
Dogs.
Yes, you might find that they eat dogs. Those are just some very quick hitting examples. A different country doesn't think the same way we think. And a book of Hebrew wisdom literature is not going to come across the same way we might think of them. So it's different from an English novel or a how-to book. Americans love their how-to books. So you start with a problem and then you answer the problem. Did this answer your question? No. Well, turn to page 5. Did this answer your question? No. Well, turn to page 10. And so on and so forth. Or an English novel that starts with guy loves a girl, guy gets a girl, guy loses a girl, guy gets a girl in the end. There's the English novel for you. And all the English majors are just just rolling over in their seats. So. Well, the commentator, it's actually not a commentary he wrote, it's some meditations on Ecclesiastes. A French philosopher named Jacques Ellul says that such outlines actually represent rational Western logic, but do not at all represent the traditional way of thinking. Rational scientific order did not preoccupy traditional thinkers and prophets. I've become thoroughly convinced that Colette follows no logical, coherent plan, nor does he treat a different question in each part. Oh, he's just highlighting the point that it's different than English. That the mindset of Hebrew prophet and poet is different. You need to become aware of that. We've noted that in the Psalms, that sometimes there's a structure to the Psalms that if you were to think as the Hebrew does, that it would, that there's a depth of meaning that brings out. Different forms that they use in poetry too is that comes out. It's also different in a second way, and I have a picture here of weaving that is going on. It's a little hard to tell. It doesn't project as well as I hope, You know what weaving is, right? So you have these vertical strands that are running this way, and what are these that you see here? Okay, that's threads that are coming horizontally this way, right? So they're weaving up and down through the vertical threads. That one has a very simple pattern, but weaving can become very complex, can it? Again, this is a weaving or a rug. There's vertical strands, but then to get all of this intricate pattern and things that we can recognize as a fish, right, comes from the weaving that takes place in that pattern. It can be very complex, can't it? Those are just, that's a basket, by the way. We do weaving and baskets, and that one, I'm not sure I could figure out exactly how this is all laid out and what the pattern is or how that works out. But there, I can guarantee you there's a pattern there, right? That's just the nature of weaving. But it's so complex, and it makes the eyes kind of swirl as you try to do that. What Jacques Ellul says is that one way that you should understand Ecclesiastes is to think of it as a weaving rather than a point-by-point-by-point Western lecture. Think of it as weaving where different themes may rise up to the top but then submerge for a time and then rise up to the top again. And there'll be repetition to some of those themes. You have the themes of meaningless, of work, of ruling and justice. Those reoccur. While you might not be able to systematically sit down and trace the actual pattern that's there, think of it as weaving rather than a logical, ordered aspect. So, again, another quote I found helpful from Ellul: in order to be prepared to hope and what does not deceive, we must first lose hope in everything that deceives. This is Colette's whole message. And that provides something of a groundwork to help us to say there is, without being kind of trite or oversimplistic, there's Solomon is at work here, wanting to present the meaninglessness of life without God so that we lose hope in it to find our hope in God alone. So some people have said, well, that's just... That's a spoonful of sugar to help the medicine go down. I thought of trying to find a picture of Mary Poppins here. He says that the harshness and bitterness of vanities find their value, perspective, and true light in Colette's proclamation of the God of Israel. The superficial reading sees this proclamation as sugar to make the pill go down, as a toning down of the text. But on the contrary, this proclamation concerning God represents the sharpest point of the text, since it gives us a different revelation of the God of Israel. Just to help you be ready to think about the meaninglessness of life without God and to be confronted with the God of Israel. One final thing, several different commentators remark that this book of the Bible came to be associated in the Hebrew year with the Feast of Booths. or the Feast of Tabernacles. Do you remember what they would do during the Feast of Tabernacles? Somebody describe what would happen. Yeah, longer than that. It was a whole week that they would forsake their homes and go and live in something constructed outside. You can find pictures of this online of modern tabernacles that seem to have a lot of amenities. I chose some pictures that might represent something a little more primitive, that besides the REI tent that's in the background there or whatever. You can see something a little more primitive. Well, think about the context of that celebration as a time where the Israelites were reminded that they, for 40 years, wandered in the wilderness. They were sustained only by God. And during that time, their clothes didn't wear out, their sandals didn't wear thin. They were provided the food that they needed. Every day that happened. Every day they were reminded that their only dependence is God. Think then of Ecclesiastes as associated with that concept of the Feast of Booths. That here we are reminded that we depend on God, and that all of the rest of life is fragile. Our solid foundations are nothing. Everything that we might think as being solid and secure is nothing. It's meaningless. Our only hope is God. That last quote that you can read there from Jacques Ellul. I'll stop there. Questions or comments that you'd like to make? We had a request to sing Psalm 72E. We'll close with that today. If you have prayer requests, I'll take those right now, then we'll distribute those by email, and then we'll close with singing. So what are your prayer requests?